And good afternoon, it's Rod McClure again, and of course we're leading into our Monday afternoon book reading. And I have to let you know that unfortunately next Monday, due to family commitments, there won't be a book reading. I'm terribly sorry about that, because we're getting very close to the end of Ivanhoe, but it's absolutely unavoidable. So I hope you'll be happy to get back in a fortnight, and we'll be able to find out pretty much the end, I think, of the story of Ivanhoe. But before we go any further, a word from the people who make our station possible.
Braidwood Butchery, our local butcher since 2003. See Mick and the team for a fantastic range of locally sourced premium meats, smoked small goods, and their newest addition, dry-aged beef, for that special occasion or just because you deserve it. Got your own meat? They can process and package that for you too. Open 6:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday to Friday and until 1 p.m. on Saturday, or give them a call for home delivery. A proud sponsor of Braidwood FM. Live local, support local.
No room in the garage for a car? The shed's so full you can't find anything? Why not use our space to create more space? Braidwood and District Storage, conveniently located at 19 Araluen Road, just behind the vets in Braidwood. Our customised, secure, professional storage facility allows you 24/7 access to all your worldly possessions. We have small to large units and parking space for boats and caravans. Call us today for a quote on 0407 701 788. Braidwood and District Storage, proud sponsors of Braidwood FM.
Braidwood Veterinary Surgery has been providing high-quality veterinary services to Braidwood and the surrounds since 1989. Their veterinarians have extensive knowledge of preventative and diagnostic health of all species, no matter how large or small. They're open Monday to Friday, 9 till 5, and Saturdays, 9 till noon. You can call them on 48 42 2697, a proud sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
For all your plumbing and gas fitting needs, Braidwood and Districts Plumbing is here to help.
They can assist with hot water installations and repairs, new builds and renovations,
block drains, septic system installations and repairs, and all other plumbing services.
They also offer 1.7 to 5.5 tonne excavator and tipper hire, and are fully licensed and insured. No job is too big or too small.
Give them a call on 0438 564 015. Braidwood and Districts Plumbing, a sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
And we've reached the point where Richard and Ivanhoe are back together again. And we'll continue on from where we were last week. Men of their precarious course of life change readily from the banquet to the battle. And to Richard, the exchange seemed but a succession of pleasure. He called for his helmet and the most cumbrous parts of his armour, which he had laid aside. While Garth was putting them on, he laid his strict injunctions on Wilfred, under pain of his highest displeasure, not to engage in the skirmish which he supposed was approaching. "You have fought for me 100 times, Wilfred, and I have seen it. You shall this day look on and see how Richard will fight for his friend and his liegeman." In the meantime, Robin Hood had set off several of his followers in different directions, as if to reconnoitre the enemy. And when he saw the company effectively broken up, he approached Richard, who was now completely armed and kneeling down on one knee, crave pardon of his sovereign. "For what, good yeoman?" said Richard, somewhat impatiently. "Have we not already granted you a full pardon for all transgressions? Think you our word is a feather to be blown backward and forward between us? You cannot have had time to commit any new offence since then." "Aye, but I have, though," answered the yeoman, "if it be an offence to deceive my prince for his own advantage. The bugle you have heard was none of Malvoisin's, but blown by my direction to break off the banquet, lest it trenched upon hours of dearer importance than to be thus dallied with." He then rose from his knee, folded his arms on his bosom, and in a manner rather respectful than submissive, awaited the answer of the king, like one who is conscious he may have given offence, yet is confident in the rectitude of his motive. The blood rushed in anger to the countenance of Richard, but it was the first transient emotion, and his sense of justice instantly subdued it. "The King of Sherwood," he said, "grudges his venison and his wine flask to the King of England? It is well, bold Robin, but when you come to see me in merry London, I trust to be a less niggardly host. You are right, however, good fellow. Let us therefore to horse and away. Wilfred has been impatient this hour. Tell me, bold Robin, have you never a friend in your band who, not content with advising, will need to direct your motions and look miserable when you presume to act for yourself?
Such a one, said Robin, is my lieutenant, Little John, who is even now absent on an expedition as far as the borders of Scotland, and I will own to your Majesty that I am sometimes displeased by the freedom of his counsels, but when I think twice, I cannot be long angry with one who can have no motive for his anxiety, save zeal for his master's service.
You are a right good yeoman, answered Richard, and if I had Ivanhoe on the one hand to give grave advice and recommend it by the sad gravity of his brow, and you on the other to trick me into what you think is for my own good, I should have as little freedom of my own will as any king in Christendom or heathenesse. But come, sirs, let us merrily on to Königsberg, and think no more on it.
Robin Hood assured them that he had detached a party in the direction of the road they were to pass, who would not fail to discover and apprise them of any secret ambush, and that he had little doubt they would find the way secure, or if otherwise would receive such timely notice of the danger as would enable them to fall back on a strong troop of archers with which he himself proposed to follow on the same route. The wise and attentive precautions adopted for his safety touched Richard's feelings and removed any slight grudge which he might retain on account of the deception the outlaw captain had practised upon him. He once more extended his hand to Robin Hood, assured him of his full pardon and future favour, as well as his firm resolution to restrain the tyrannical exercise of the forest rights and other oppressive laws by which so many English yeomen were driven into a state of rebellion. But Richard's good intentions towards the bold outlaw were frustrated by the king's untimely death, and the charter of the forest was extorted from the unwilling hands of King John when he succeeded to his heroic brother. As for the rest of Robin Hood's career, as well as the tale of his treacherous death, they are to be found in those black-lettered garlands once sold at the low and easy rate of 1/2 penny. How cheaply purchased at their weight in gold. The outlaw's opinion proved true, and the king, attended by Ivanhoe, Garth and Wamba, arrived without any interruption within a view of the castle of Königsberg while the sun was yet on the horizon. There are few more beautiful or striking scenes in England than are presented by the vicinity of this ancient Saxon fortress. The soft and gentle River Don sweeps through an amphitheatre in which cultivation is richly blended with woodland, and on a mound ascending from the river, well defended by walls and ditches, rises this ancient edifice, which, as its Saxon name implies, was previous to the conquest a royal residence of the kings of England. The outer walls have probably been added by the Normans, but the inner keep bears token of very great antiquity. It is situated on a mount at one angle of the inner court, and forms a complete circle of perhaps 25 feet in diameter. The wall is of immense thickness, and is propped or defended by 6 huge external buttresses, which project from the circle and rise up against the sides of the tower, as if to strengthen or to support it. These massive buttresses are solid when they arise from the foundation and a good way higher up, but are hollowed out towards the top and terminate in a sort of turrets communicating with the interior of the keep itself. The distant appearance of this huge building with these singular accompaniments is as interesting to the lovers of the picturesque as the interior of the castle is to the eager antiquary whose imagination it carries back to the days of the Heptarchy. A barrow in the vicinity of the castle is pointed out as the tomb of the memorable Hengist, and various monuments of great antiquity and curiosity are shown in the neighbouring churchyard. When Coeur de Lion and his retinue approached this rude yet stately building, it was not as at present surrounded by external fortifications. The Saxon architect had exhausted his art in rendering the main keep defensible, and there was no other circumvallation than a rude barrier of palisades. A huge black banner, which floated from the top of the tower, announced that the obsequies of the late owner was still in the act of being solemnised. It bore no emblem of the deceased's birth or quality, for armorial bearings were then a novelty among the Norman chivalry themselves and were totally unknown to the Saxons. But above the gate was another banner on which the figure of a white horse, rudely painted, indicated the nation and rank of the deceased by the well-known symbol of Hengist and his Saxon warriors. All around the castle was a scene of busy commotion, for such funeral banquets were times of general and profuse hospitality, which not only everyone who could claim the most distant connection with the deceased, but all passengers whatsoever were invited to partake. The wealth and consequence of the deceased, Athelstane, occasioned this custom to be observed in the fullest extent. Numerous parties, therefore, were seen ascending and descending the hill on which the castle was situated, and when the king and his attendants entered the open and unguarded gates of the external barrier, the space within presented a scene not easily reconciled with the cause of the assemblage. In one place cooks were toiling to roast huge oxen and fat sheep, in another hogsheads of ale were set abroach to be drained at the freedom of all comers. Groups of every description were to be seen devouring the food and swallowing the liquor, thus abandoned to their discretion. The naked Saxon serf was drowning the sense of his half-year's hunger and thirst in one day of gluttony and drunkenness. The more pampered burgess and guild brother was eating his morsel with gusto or curiously criticising the quality of the malt and the skill of the brewer. Some few of the poorer Norman gentry might also be seen distinguished by their shaven chins and short cloaks, and not less so by their keeping together and looking with great scorn on the whole solemnity, even while condescending to avail themselves of the good cheer which was so liberally supplied. Mendicants were, of course, assembled by the score, together with strolling soldiers returned from Palestine, according to their own account at least. Peddlers were displaying their wares, travelling mechanics were inquiring after employment, and wandering palmers, hedge priests, Saxon minstrels and Welsh bards were muttering prayers and extracting mistuned dirges from their harps, crowds, and a rote, a type of early guitar. One sent forth the praises of Athelstane in a doleful panegyric, another in a Saxon genealogical poem rehearsed the uncouth and harsh names of his noble ancestry. Jesters and jugglers were not a-wanting, nor was the occasion of the assembly supposed to render the exercise of their profession indecorous or improper. Indeed, the ideas of the Saxons on these occasions were as natural as they were rude. If sorrow was thirsty, there was drink. If hungry, there was food. If it sunk down upon and saddened the heart, here were the means supplied of mirth or at least of amusement. Nor did the assistants scorn to avail themselves of those means of consolation, although every now and then, as if suddenly recollecting the cause which had brought them together, the men groaned in unison, while the females, of whom many were present, raised up their voices and shrieked for very woe. Such was the scene in the castle yard at Königsberg when it was entered by Richard and his followers. The seneschal, or steward, deigned not to take notice of the groups of inferior guests who were perpetually entering and withdrawing, unless so far as was necessary to preserve order. Nevertheless, he was struck by the good outlook of the monarch and Ivanhoe, more especially as he imagined the features of the latter were familiar to him. Besides, the approach of two knights, for such their dress bespoke them, was a rare event at a Saxon solemnity, and could not but be regarded as a sort of honour to the deceased and his family. And in his sable dress, and holding in his hand his white wand of office, this important personage made way through the miscellaneous assemblage of guests, thus conducting Richard and Ivanhoe to the entrance of the tower. Garth and Wamba speedily found acquaintances in the courtyard, nor presumed to intrude themselves any further until their presence should be required. Chapter 42. The mode of entering the great tower of Königsberg Castle is very peculiar and partakes of the rude simplicity of the early times in which it was erected. A flight of steps so steep and narrow as to be almost precipitous leads up to a low portal in the south side of the tower by which the adventurous antiquary may still, or at least could a few years since, gain access to a small stair within the thickness of the main wall of the tower, which leads up to a third story of the building, the two lower being dungeons or vaults, which neither receive air nor light, save by a square hole in the third story, with which they seem to be communicated by a ladder. The access to the upper apartments in the tower, which consist in all of four stories, is given by stairs which are carried up through the external buttresses. By this difficult and complicated entrance, the good King Richard, followed by his faithful Ivanhoe, was ushered into the round apartment which occupies the whole of the third story from the ground. Wilfred, by the difficulties of the ascent, gained time to muffle his face in his mantle, as it had been held expedient that he should not present himself to his father until the king should give him the signal. There were assembled in this apartment around a large oaken table about a dozen of the most distinguished representatives of the Saxon families in the adjacent counties. These were all old, or at least elderly men, for the younger race, to the great displeasure of the seniors, had, like Ivanhoe, broken down many of the barriers which separated for half a century the Norman victors from the vanquished Saxons. The downcast and sorrowful looks of these venerable men, their silence and their mournful postures, formed a strong contrast to the levity of the revellers on the outside of the castle. Their grey locks and long full beards, together with their antique tunics and loose black mantles, suited well with the singular and rude apartment in which they were seated, and gave the appearance of a band of ancient worshippers of Woden, recalled to life to mourn over the decay of their national glory. Cedric, seated in equal rank amongst his countrymen, seemed yet by common consent to act as chief of the assembly. Upon the entrance of Richard, only known to him as the valorous knight of the Fetterlock, he arose gravely and gave him welcome by the ordinary salutation, "Was hail," raising at the same time a goblet to his head. The king, no stranger to the customs of his English subjects, returned the greeting with the appropriate words, "Drink heil," and took part drinking in the cup which was handed to him by the same. The same courtesy was offered to Ivanhoe, who pledged his father in silence, supplying the usual speech by an inclination of his head, unless his voice should have been recognised. When this introductory ceremony was performed, Cedric arose and, extending his hand to Richard, conducted him to a small and very rude chapel, which was excavated, as it were, out of one of the external buttresses. And there was no opening save a very narrow loophole. The place would have been nearly quite dark but for two flambeaux, or torches, which showed by a red and smoky light the arched roof and naked walls, the rude altar of stone, and the crucifix of the same material. Before this altar was placed a bier, and on each side of this bier kneeled three priests, who told their beads and muttered their prayers with the greatest signs of external devotion. For this service a splendid solscat was paid to the convent of St. Edmund's by the mother of the deceased, and, that it might be fully deserved, the whole brethren, saving the lame sacristan, who had transferred themselves to Königsberg, where while six of their number were constantly on guard in the performance of divine rites by the bier of Athelstan, the others failed not to take their share of the refreshments and amusements which went on at the castle. In maintaining this pious watch and ward, the good monks were particularly careful not to interrupt their hymns for an instant, lest Zernebock, the ancient Saxon Apollyon, should lay his clutches on the departed Athelstan. Nor were they less careful to prevent any unhallowed layman from touching the pall, which, having been that used at the funeral of St. Edmund, was liable to be desecrated if handled by the profane. If in truth these attentions could be of any use to the deceased, he had some right to expect them at the hands of the brethren of St. Edmund's, since beside 100 mancuses of gold paid down as the sole ransom, the mother of Athelstan had announced her intention of endowing that foundation with the better part of the lands of the deceased in order to maintain perpetual prayers for his soul and that of her departed husband. Richard and Wilfred followed the Saxon Cedric into the apartment of death, where, as their guide pointed with solemn air to the untimely bier of Athelstan, they followed his example in devoutly crossing themselves and muttering a brief prayer for the well-being of the departed soul. This act of pious charity performed, Cedric again motioned them to follow him, gliding over the stone floor with a noiseless tread, and after ascending a few steps, opened with great caution the door of a small oratory, which adjoined to the chapel. It was about 8 feet square, hollowed like the chapel itself, out of the thickness of the wall, and the loophole which enlightened it, being to the west and widening considerably as it sloped inward, a beam of the setting sun found its way into its dark recess and showed a female of a dignified look and whose countenance retained the marked remains of majestic beauty. Her long mourning robes and her flowing wimple of black cypress enhanced the whiteness of her skin and the beauty of her light-coloured and flowing tresses, which time had neither thinned nor mingled with silver. Her countenance expressed the deepest sorrow that is consistent with resignation. On the stone table before her stood a crucifix of ivory, beside which was laid a missal, having its pages richly illuminated and its boards adorned with clasps of gold and bosses of the same precious metal. "Noble Edith," said Cedric, after having stood a moment silent, as if to give Richard and Wilfred time to look upon the lady of the mansion, "these are worthy strangers come to take a part in your sorrows. And this in especial is the valiant knight who fought so bravely for the deliverance of him for whom we this day mourn."
"His bravery has my thanks," returned the lady, "although it be the will of heaven that it should be displayed in vain. I thank too his courtesy, and that of his companion, which has brought them here to behold the widow of Adeling, the mother of Athelstan, in her deep hour of sorrow and lamentation. To your care, kind kinsman, I entrust them, satisfied that they will want no hospitality which these sad walls can yet afford." The guests bowed deeply to the mourning parent and withdrew with their hospitable guide. Another winding stair conducted them to an apartment of the same size with that which they had first entered, occupying indeed the story immediately above. From this room, ere yet the door was opened, proceeded a low and melancholy strain of vocal music. When they entered, they found themselves in the presence of about 20 matrons and maidens of distinguished Saxon lineage. Four maidens, Rowena leading the choir, raised a hymn for the soul of the deceased, of which we have only been able to decipher two or three stanzas. "Dust unto dust, to this all must. The tenant hath resigned the faded form. To waste and worm, corruption claims her kind. Through paths unknown thy soul hath flown, to seek the realms of woe, where fiery pain shall purge the stain of actions done below. In that sad place, by Mary's grace, brief may thy dwelling be, till prayers and alms and holy psalms shall set the captive free." While this dirge was sung in a low and a melancholy tone by the female choristers, the others were divided into two bands, of which one was engaged in bedecking, with such embroidery as their skill and taste could compass, a large silken pall destined to cover the bier of Athelstan, while the others busied themselves in selecting from baskets of flowers placed before them garlands which they intended for the same mournful purpose. The behaviour of the maidens was decorous, if not marked with deep affliction, but now and then a whisper or a smile called forth the rebuke of the severer matrons, and here and there might be seen a damsel more interested in her endeavouring to find out how her mourning robe became her than in the dismal ceremony for which they were preparing. Neither was this propensity, if we must needs confess the truth, at all diminished by the appearance of two strange knights, which occasioned some looking up, peeping and whispering. Rowena alone, too proud to be vain, paid her greeting to her deliverer with a graceful courtesy. Her demeanour was serious but not dejected, and it may be doubted whether thoughts of Ivanhoe and of the uncertainty of his fate did not claim as great a share in her gravity as the death of her kinsman. To Cedric, however, who, as we have observed, was not remarkably clear-sighted on such occasions, the sorrow of this ward seemed so much deeper than of any other maiden's that she deemed it proper to whisper the explanation. She was the affianced bride of the noble Athelstan. It may be doubted whether this communication went a far way to increase Wilfred's disposition to sympathise with the mourners of Koningsberg. Having thus formally introduced the guests to the different chambers in which the obsequies of Athelstan were celebrated under different forms, Cedric conducted them into a small room destined, as he informed them, for the exclusive accommodation of honourable guests, whose more slight connection with the deceased might render them unwilling to join those who were immediately affected by the unhappy event. He assured them of every accommodation and was about to withdraw when the Black Knight took his hand. "I crave to remind you, noble Thane," he said,
that when we last parted, you promised for the service that I had the fortune to render you to grant me a boon.
Oh, it's granted ere named, noble knight, said Cedric. Yet at this sad moment
of that also, said the king, I have bethought me, but my time is brief. Neither does it seem to me unfit that, when closing the grave on the noble Athelstan, we shall deposit therein certain prejudices and hasty opinions.
Sir Knight of the Fetterlock, said Cedric, colouring and interrupting the king in his turn, I trust your boon regards yourself and no other, for in that which concerns the honour of my house, it is scarce fitting that a stranger should mingle.
Nor do I wish to mingle, said the king mildly, unless in so far as you will admit me to have an interest. As yet you have known me but as the Black Knight of the Fetterlock. Know me now as Richard Plantagenet.
Richard of Anjou,
exclaimed Cedric, stepping backwards with the utmost astonishment. No, noble Cedric, Richard of England, whose deepest interest, whose deepest wish, is to see her sons united with each other. And how now, worthy thane, have you no knee for your prince?
To Norman blood, said Cedric, it has never bent.
Reserve your homage, then, said the monarch, until I shall prove my right to it by my equal protection of Normans and English.
Prince, answered Cedric, I have ever done justice to your bravery and your worth, nor am I ignorant of your claim to the crown, through your descent from Matilda, niece to Edgar Atheling, and daughter to Malcolm of Scotland. But Matilda, though of royal Saxon blood, was not the heir to the monarchy.
I will not dispute my title with you, noble thane, said Richard calmly, but I will bid you look around you, and see where you will find another to be put into the scale against it.
And have you wondered here, prince, to tell me so, said Cedric, to upbraid me with the ruin of my race, ere the grave was closed over the last scion of Saxon royalty?
His countenance darkened as he spoke.
It was boldly, it was rashly done.
Not so by the holy rood, replied the king. It was done in the frank confidence which one brave man may repose in another without a shadow of danger.
You say well, Sir King, for king I own you are, and will be, despite my feeble opposition. I dare not take the only mode to prevent it, though you have placed the strong temptation within my reach. And now to my boon, said the king, which I ask not with one jot the less confidence than you have refused to acknowledge my lawful sovereignty. I require of you, as a man of your word, on pain of being held faithless, man-sworn, infamous, to forgive and receive to your paternal affection the good knight Wilfred of Ivanhoe. In this reconciliation you will own I have an interest, the happiness of my friend, and the quelling of dissension among my faithful people.
And this is Wilfred, said Cedric, pointing to his son. My father, my father, said Ivanhoe, prostrating himself at Cedric's feet. Grant me your forgiveness.
You have it, my son, said Cedric, raising him up. The son of Hereward knows how to keep his word, even when it has been passed to a Norman. But let me see you use the dress and costume of your English ancestry. No short cloaks, no gay bonnets, no fantastic plumage in my decent household. He that would be the son of Cedric must show himself of English ancestry. You are about to speak, he added sternly, and I guess the topic. The Lady Rowena must complete 2 years mourning. As for a betrothed husband, all our Saxon ancestors would disown us were we to treat of a new union for her before the grave of him she should have wedded, him so much the most worthy of her hand by birth and ancestry, is yet closed. The ghost of Athelstan himself would burst his bloody cerements and stand before us to forbid such dishonour to his memory. It seemed as if Cedric's words had raised a spectre, for scarce had he uttered them ere the door flew open, and Athelstan, arrayed in the garments of the grave, stood before them, pale, haggard, and like something arisen from the dead. Just as an aside, Scott wrote at the bottom of the page in a footnote that He has been criticised for resurrecting Athelstan, but his publisher insisted on it. Continuing on. The effect of this apparition on the persons present was utterly appalling. Cedric started back as far as the wall of the apartment would permit and leaned against it as one unable to support himself, gazing on the figure of his friend with eyes that seemed fixed and a mouth which he appeared incapable of shutting. Ivanhoe crossed himself, repeating prayers in Saxon, Latin or Norman French as they occurred to his memory, while Richard alternately said, Benedicite, and swore, Mort, mort de ma vie. In the meantime, a horrible noise was heard below the stairs, some crying, Secure the treacherous monks! Others, Down with them to the dungeons! Others, Pitch them from the highest battlements! In the name of God, said Cedric, addressing what seemed the spectre of his departed friend. If you are mortal, speak. If a departed spirit, say for what cause you visit us, or if I can do aught that can set your spirit at ease. Living or dead, noble Athelstan, speak to Cedric. I will, said the spectre very composedly, when I have collected breath, and when you give me time. Alive, said you? I'm as much alive as he can be who has fed on bread and water for 3 days, which seem 3 ages. Yes, bread and water, Father Cedric. By heaven and all saints, in it better food hath not passed my hand for 3 livelong days, and by God's providence it is that I am now here to tell it. Why, noble Athelstan, said the Black Knight, I myself saw you struck down by the fierce Templar, toward the end of the storm at Torquilston, and as I thought and Wamba reported, your skull was cloven to the teeth. You thought amiss, Sir Knight, said Athelstan, and Wamba lied. My teeth are in good order, and that my supper shall presently find. No thanks to the Templar, though, whose sword turned in his hand, so that the blade struck me flat, being averted by the handle of the good mace with which I warded the blow. Had my steel cap been on, I had not valued it a rush, and had dealt him such a counterbuff as would have spoilt his retreat. But as it was, down I went, stunned indeed, but unwounded. Others of both sides were beaten down and slaughtered above me, so that I never recovered my senses until I found myself in a coffin, an open one by good luck, placed before the altar of the Church of St. Edmund's. I sneezed repeatedly, groaned, awakened, and would have arisen, when the sacristan and abbot, full of terror, came running at the noise, surprised doubtless, and no way pleased to find the man alive, whose heirs they had proposed themselves to be. I asked for wine. They gave me some, but it must have been highly medicated, for I slept yet more deeply than before, and wakened not for many, many hours. Then I found my arms swathed down, my feet tied so fast that my ankles ache at the very remembrance. The place was utterly dark, the oubliette, I suppose, of their accursed convent, and from the close, stifled, damp smell, I conceived it was also a place of sepulture. I had strange thoughts of what had befallen me when the door of my dungeon creaked and 2 villain monks entered. They would have persuaded me I was in purgatory, but I knew too well the pursy, short-breathed voice of the Father Abbot. Saint Jeremy, how different from that tone with which he used to ask me for another slice of the haunch. The dog has feasted with me from Christmas to Twelfth Night. Have patience, noble Athelstan, said the king. Take breath, tell your story at leisure. Show me but such a tale is well worth listening to as a romance. Aye, but by the rood of Brumholm, there was no romance in the matter, said Athelstan. A barley loaf and a pitcher of water, and they gave me the niggardly traitors whom my father and myself had enriched when their best resources were flitches of bacon and measures of corn out of which they wheedled poor serfs and bondsmen in exchange for their prayers. The nest of foul, ungrateful vipers, barley, bread and ditch water to such a patron as I had been. I'll smoke them out of their nest, though I be excommunicated.
But in the name of Our Lady, Athelstane, said Cedric, grasping the hand of his friend, how did you escape this imminent danger? Did their hearts relent?
Did their hearts relent? Echoed Athelstane. Do rocks melt with the sun? I should have been there still, had not some stir in the convent, which I find was their procession here to eat at my funeral feast, when they well knew how and where I had been buried alive, summoned the swarm out of the hive. I heard them droning out their death psalms, little judging they were sung in respect for my soul by those who were thus famishing my body. They went, however, and I waited long for food. No wonder the gouty sacristan was even too busy with his own provender to mind mine. At length down he came with an unstable step and a strong flavour of wine and spices about his person. Ah, good cheer had opened his heart, for he left me a nook of pasty and a flask of wine. Instead of my former fare, I ate, drank, was invigorated, when to add to my good luck, the sacristan, too totty to discharge his duty of turnkey fitly, locked the door beside the staple so that it fell ajar. The light, the food, the wine, set my invention to work. The staple to which my chains were fixed was more rusted than I or the villain abbot had supposed. Even iron could not remain without consuming in the damps of that infernal dungeon. "Take breath, noble Athelstane," said Richard, "and partake of some refreshment before you proceed with a tale so dreadful." "Partake," quoth Athelstane. "I have been partaking five times today, and yet a morsel of that savoury ham were not altogether foreign to the matter, and I pray you, fair sir, to do me reason in a cup of wine." The guests, though still agape with astonishment, pledged their resuscitated landlord, who thus proceeded with his story. How, indeed, many, many more auditors than those to whom it was commenced, for Edith, having given certain necessary orders for arranging matters within the castle, had followed the dead alive up to the stranger's apartment, attended by as many of the guests, male and female, as could squeeze into the small room, while others, crowding the staircase, caught up an erroneous edition of the story. They transmitted it still more inaccurately to those beneath, who again sent it forth to the vulgar without, in a fashion totally irreconcilable to the real fact. Athelstane, however, went on as follows with the history of his escape. "Finding myself freed from the staple, I dragged myself up the stairs as well as a man loaded with shackles and emaciated with fasting might, and after much groping about, I was at length directed by the sound of a jolly roundelay to the apartment where the worthy sacristan, an it so please you, was holding a devil's mass with a huge beetle-browed, broad-shouldered brother of the grey frock and cowl, who looked much more like a thief than a clergyman. I burst in upon them, and the fashion of my grave clothes, as well as the clanking of my chains, made me more resemble an inhabitant of the other world than this. Both stood aghast. But when I knocked down the sacristan with my fist, the other fellow, his pot companion, fetched a blow at me with a huge quarterstaff." "This must be our Friar Tuck for a count's ransom," said Richard, looking at Ivanhoe. "He may be the devil, and he will," said Athelstane. "Fortunately, he missed the aim, and on my approaching to grapple with him, took to his heels and ran for it. I failed not to set my own heels at liberty by means of the fetter key, which hung amongst others at the sexton's belt, and I had thoughts of beating out the knave's brains with the bunch of keys, but gratitude for the nook of pastry and the flask of wine which the rascal had imparted to my captivity came over my heart, so with a brace of hearty kicks I left him on the floor, pouched some baked meat and a leathern bottle of wine with which the two venerable brethren had been regaling, went to the stable and found in a private stall my own best palfrey, which doubtless had been set apart for the Holy Father Abbot's particular use. Hither I came with all the speed the beast could compass, man and mother's son flying before me, wherever I came, taking me for a spectre, the more especially as, to prevent my being recognised, I drew the corpse hood over my face. I had not gained admittance into my own castle had I not been supposed to be the attendant of a juggler who is making the people in the castle yard very merry, considering they are assembled to celebrate their lord's funeral. I say, the person thought I was dressed to bear a part in the Tregator's mummery, and so I got admission and did but disclose myself to my mother and eat a hasty morsel ere I came in quest of you, my noble friend." "And you have found me," said Cedric, "ready to resume our brave projects of honour and liberty. I tell you, never will dawn a morrow so auspicious as the next for the deliverance of the noble Saxon race."
there we leave Ivanhoe for this week. Remember, unfortunately, next week there'll be no reading, and I hope to be back in a fortnight, able to continue on with Sir Walter Scott's Ivanhoe. Keep well during the fortnight, Brady.